mundane, the worldly. I don't know. I shouldn't think of it as a male-female tendency because it's not. Mm-hmm. But I, there's a stereotypical thing about me sometimes that I think you and I can share that I think also is shared in our wives. There's a certain like practical focus on what needs to be done, on the mechanics of what needs to be done. And
yes,
I think you and I can have this tendency to have the general, the broad, the universal in our focus throughout the day, almost like, you know, this mundane world, you know, the mundane world, which is almost right, repeating myself, the worldly world.
Yes.
Is dragging me down from what needs to be focused on. But then in my experience, you know, the women in my life, and maybe this is because this is the kind of woman I've been attracted to because I needed this sort of grounding in my life, have reminded me that, you know, you live in the world, dummy. This is what needs to be done. And this is, you know, to imagine that the universal looms larger than what needs to be done right now, is a little bit, I don't know. I don't have a better word for it than pie in the sky off the top of my head right now.
But, yeah. Well, I guess the work in for me is to, ground the pedestrian,
yeah,
the, what has to be taken in the eternal.
And that's to so not funny let, to call that grounding, right?
Yeah, that actually...
Like only you and I would call that one grounding, right?
Without the eternal, or without, to me, we'll go with that, without a noetic or a worldview permeating the individual actions lose their meaning. And the worldview without individual actions causes worldview to lose its meaning. It doesn't... They need each other, like, that seems to me, so, and then, of course, what we deem practical, you know, we think, well, someone in a yogic tradition where you see a constant reminder of death is encouraged, or someone in what's a Sufi tradition, where if you're the Quran is your main book, it's death on every page. It's the remembrance of death to bring you to an awareness of ultimate being or ultimate reality or truth or God or a higher value and that to me is the only thing that makes doing the will or the lawn mowing or fixing or putting oil in the truck or building, all that stuff gets very overwhelming and neurotic and filled with anxiety if it's not done. If we're not looking for God's will in those,
I think for you and I, right, who would sort of try to poo-poo the dichotomy between, you know, science and religion or something, right? They should both be seeking truth and should reflect one another. In a sense, we're describing a sort of ignorance when we talk about the dichotomy between the practical world and the realm of the heart or the realm of the spirit. And if they don't, to say that they're at odds is to say that we're doing one or more of them incorrectly, because they're not different. If the practical world is at odds with deeper truth or vice versa, then, you know, it could only be because they're wrong.
Might mean I'm on the wrong track.
I feel like that has to be true, that it shouldn't be, well, you know, I'm setting aside time from practical matters to focus on maintaining my spirit. Well,
that's a delicate line, though, however.
Yeah.
However, I will say that's a delicate line in the sense that without setting those times aside, I can't keep the mojo going all day.
What could be more practical?
Right. It's impractical to not drop the utilitarian world of pressures and things that have to be done for periods of time during the day or once a day or twice a day or however we work our lives.
But of course, watering my heart health, and we're saying this, you know, we agree, I'm just, you know, arguing for a vernacular that suggests that watering our heart is a strictly practical matter, you know, is utilitarian. Yeah. Like if I don't nurture this thing, I'm going to get angry and fussy and I'm going to do a shitty job of the practical things that need to be tended to.
Suffice to say, I do feel like I live in a world that stresses action and results and noticeable effects. And I've had to swim upstream in a certain sense. And as a result, a myopic weirdness has sometimes crept in, which my extraordinary practical and spiritual wife and profoundly grounded keeps in check. And so, I mean, especially my hermetic tendencies now, because I don't believe the contemplation that maybe we are humbly as striving for the vision that we strive for, it actually needs the pressures of life. I actually need the obedience to what life is precisely. And for me, I would say God is giving me in this moment to do. And so I literally can't lead a contemplative life, a spiritual life without it. So not only are they not in contradiction, or there's some way in which one's practically, it's a without which the other won't occur. So
I think,
I don't know.
I think that has to be true.
Right. Because I need you.
Like people manage to do one or the other or.
Right.
But I'm not sure if they do. And maybe someone even will. I'm not sure, but not me. I don't seem to do them well. And it's not my place to say that everyone else is screwing it up their way. But I'm confident that I screw it up when I'm doing only one or the other. Although it was pretty good, I gotta say though, it's not reasonable for me now. But when I try to do the strictly practical without maintaining my heart, there are real problems. When I did the, maintained a more quote spiritual life unquote. I don't know what that means. When I was just doing that full time, when I was when I was vocationally.
Watering the heart,
studying and practicing. was actually pretty good, and I didn't. Now this depended on a lot of other people doing practical things, many of whom were happy to support me in that way, and that was cool, and it was very powerful.
Our little sangha in Charlottesville, did a bunch of practical stuff. I mean, the amount of tasks that those students so that you could be in retreat.
Absolutely. And it was an extraordinary powerful time for me. But it was still dependent upon the practical, even if I wasn't the one doing it as much. And now, whatever, I'm back to drawing this dichotomy that I'm rejecting, because obviously I feel it, right? Of course, I feel it very intensely. Yes. And right when I say that, like, I'm pointing to some sort of an ignorance, let's not mistake who I claim it dwells in, I feel that dichotomy very, very strongly. And it was amazing. Yeah. And not just for those 3 years. I mean, my goodness, actually those 3 years, God bless you, Charlottesville Sangha and the others and the caretakers who lived there and supported me, but also the 7 years prior, when I lived in a tent or traveled the world and I just studied and did this thing. And I'm so grateful for that time. And it was good. And I was very happy. I was very happy. I mean, I think, I don't know. I wonder how it looks to you. And I know there's a whole question about whether, raw, simple, stupid happiness is the best measure or not. And I think there are a lot of measures we could bust out, but you've known me in both modes. I don't know now that I'm in balance, as it were, or trying to balance more my practical and spiritual life. And maybe this is a measure of how I'm still doing it badly, but I don't know, like today, that I'm as happy. I mean, did you perceive me as a conspicuously jolly fellow at the time? And do I? What about Ben then and Ben now?
Because
when Ben lived this full time,
Well, I don't know. I do sense that if we change a situation and happiness shifts, there's something in the situation before in which we thought ourselves to be happy or perhaps were. I'm almost wanting to reframe the whole thing as if to transcend both in a certain way, the time in the desert with friends studying these beautiful things and traveling. And to some extent, this is what I did many months out of the year, largely because of my wife's support and the support of my teacher and friends. And so I also felt similar things. Now, when the greater pressures, kids in college and started to come in, I had converted to Christianity, and the whole, I don't want to call it the game, but the what I'm understanding from the Gospels is that what you're experiencing, the care for children, the care for wife, is God's will for you.
Yes.
Like, God's will is not always so hard to discern, and especially if I feel resistance to taking care of something. It's not always this mysterious thing. Like, install the thing correctly. If you're building a home, you're giving glory to truth if we're doing it with care and without the anxiety of a rat race mentality or trying to just simply make money. That there's a whole... So
I
for
don't
me
need to say that I'm better off that I was better off then or now, you know, but I still kind of want your feelings on the question. Like, you don't just, if you decide that I seemed happier then, it doesn't mean that you're then asserting
that I
was a better man.
I honestly didn't I'm not dodging the question. I'm actually trying to go through my own life and trying to reconfigure the notion of happiness. What I knew you to be and what I know you to be now, I don't see a vast different level in happiness from, so my instinctual answer is that. I do also know that though that you have had trials that simply did not and would not have come up
right
in the life in the desert of Arizona and in the life of serving and studying in the ways that we did. So
and also our trials, Also our trials at the time were so valuable. I mean, I tend to have this, right? I think of Bob Dylan's Dream, right? This song, riding on a train going west, I fell asleep for to take my rest. I dreamed a dream that made me sad concerning myself and the first few friends I ever had. With half damp eyes, I stared through the room where my friends and I spent many an afternoon. We thought we could sit forever in fun, and our chances really was 1,000,000 to 1. And on some level, I envision this time like that, but also some of the most powerful, beautiful, disarming, joyful times were when we were busting our ass, working hard and building and working and something about the trials, the, I don't know, I wanted like expansion and contraction, and like the all the muscles tight to achieve a task together, that then when we relaxed, holy shit, did we relax together. And it, you know, it wasn't a time without trials. It wasn't the same trials.
The stakes are different when a child is there and you're in the city of life. You're
of
in the stuff. And so the happiness that can come on the other side of holding those trials with a kind of free obedience, a kind of a freedom that happens only in bowing down to our children's needs and our wife's needs, that it doesn't quite compare to building a cabin for a friend in the heat of the desert or in carrying bricks all the way up a hill. It's almost as if, and then it almost, those trials prepare us for deeper and deeper familial humility and the beauty of the path of a father and a husband and all that it entails. Now, I will say there was something of the glory days about those days and how to incorporate that spirit into the sort of fray that I have been in finishing, you know, a $1.5 million house and for a client or whatever it is, and getting, you know, children through college, there's something a little bit more, it's a little, lifting's a little heavier and the pressure's a little more on. And so living, I feel a certain happiness because I sense an authenticity and a clarity in that service. Whereas my service to friends in a desert so that they could spend time meditating while I was completely behind it and believed in it, the extent to which it took time away from my family was always very hard. And I tried to balance it, and I don't think I did. And I think that my values have shifted since then. So,
yeah.
But I don't strike, whenever I'm with you, I sense a buoyancy, even when you're going through it. Like, I think 2 years ago was rough. There's certain things you, but there's this happiness that I feel returning in your voice and in your being, which is very exciting to me. There's something shifting. So I will say that 3 years, there are times when I'm thinking, oh, he's just not at that same level of relaxation and happiness that we had at Diamond Mountain. And now I feel like there is a depth and lightness of being that is coming back into you. But perhaps that's not true. I don't know. What would you say?
I don't know. Yeah, I was hoping I could believe that.
Yes, but alas, not.
I don't know. No, I don't know. I hope so. I also hope so. And there's something about, yeah, the honesty of what I'm working with and right, accepting the cross, as you would say, that what God has asked of me. And, I have this very weird practice that we were taught that we don't talk as much about now, you know, but that we talked a lot about at one point, where I accepted this very Buddhist tantric practice about who God was, and I followed her, and I accepted, you know, for me to serve my wife, you know, and then to have her, you know, ask for a child, and then to have a child to serve, you know, this is when, on my good days, when I can remember, you know, this is who I promised was God. And not to say that then somehow some, you know, someone else isn't in that right, way, right. But that this is what I'm capable of.
Sort of practical.
what I'm capable of aspiring to, is that right?
What I'm capable of, dear.
Right. What I feel capable of aspiring to is being able to see my wife and child, and you know, maybe a few close friends that way on a really good day. I mean, more so than my llama, frankly. Which for me was his, you know, also like his main teaching to me is, it should be her, not me. And I'm here and it's cool. And to the extent that you can make it her rather than me, I think this is all going to go a lot better for you. And, boy, I think that was fantastic advice, for my life. I'm loath to think what things would have looked like if I hadn't followed that.
Yeah.
And there's also some, like, you know, if I can serve people, I've got to be where they are. And I hope that I'm doing that. I'm really trying hard to do that. I'm trying, I guess, if I look at my life, I am trying to craft a life in which I'm serving people. And there is this humility, right? You brought up this thing, humility. And, I'm so humble. We talked about humility and boy, does it feel nice? Humility. Sometimes it feels like it's really hard, and I'm struggling with this. What I do now encourages a sort of humility, but I have to eye it very closely to see there's this line between holy humility or the illness of excessive self-deprecation and self-doubt. And I don't know clearly how to walk the line between those two. It's a real challenge for me.
Yeah. Humility seems to me to be very slim. It sort of can't be had without faith. So there's a deep connection there. When we have a certain level of faith in the mystery of love or love's action in our hearts, humility, I think, is experienced as a peacefulness, a relief in emptying out images of self and images of self-concern and the images that produce anxiety. So it feels like often the effect in one's being, we can see the difference between the genuine humility and the false humility, because the false humility, it leads to some sort of, now not to say that there isn't an aspect of humiliation in the life of someone embracing humility, but the sense of self-emptying and letting go of baggage seems to me more getting less heavy, carrying a less around, less conceptual poundage and prejudgment and prejudice.
You can't look to yourself and see if yourself is amassing that quality, can you? Right? Ben accruing the quality of humility yet? You know, there's this temptation to look in
you're
and see.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Now, but sometimes you can see something about the nature of my pride when I'm praised. I'm kind of in any way put off balance and kind of get like, oh no, or deny it, or kind of take it on like a Labrador. We see a lot
either way.
One who is humble just receives praise as if it is the Holy Spirit in them. It is the bodhicitta. They're not being it. They don't. A person who's humble doesn't get caught by praise. Uh-huh. It doesn't move the person one way or the other. It may be encouraging in a certain sense, but it's not, it doesn't make for awkwardness in the room at all. So then I'm always aware, well, I really lack humility because I see that it's pride. Right. I see
if you could hear praise upon you as praise of God before you, you know?
Or something came through me and I know that's a little bit of a gymnastic, but Dalai Lama says, you practice it until maybe one day, oh gosh, it is God working in me. And that's that doesn't mean there's some uber way everyone, God working in me is my true self working in me or a deeper, the being we want to encourage it's not ultimately different, I don't think. I don't know. I'm sort of beyond my capabilities now when I go into this territory, but it seems helpful to be, you know, when Jesus, I said it in two podcasts ago, you know, Jesus is like, don't call me good. Only my Father in heaven is good. You know, only God is good. Only the absolute is good. Please don't make that mistake. And I just, there's something kind of it feels good to not, it doesn't feel, that feels like something right in that. It feels like something we should try out. And maybe one day it doesn't feel fake. You know, it actually, oh gosh, this, perhaps I am being moved by the, like the way the wind, the way the trees move in the wind. You know, they move beautifully because of the wind. You know, right. They're not like, right. Oh, I move so beautifully. You're like, oh, I move beautifully because of that spirit we can't see.
I think my unhealthy, maybe I'm trying it out, you know, but my unhealthy humility is when someone praises me and I am afraid of myself getting carried away by their praise. I'm afraid of making too much of it. I'm afraid of them seeing me take it wrong or be too proud or something. I'm afraid of them thinking, yes, I know, I'm so good. Or I'm afraid of myself thinking that. And my hunch is that humility is not fear.
Doesn't have
in the way
fear.
I'm looking for. Yeah, or not that fear.
Maybe my hunch is that that's a part of the process, though, and that you're not far off to be like, I need to be careful now. Like, it feels like if that thought comes up, I need to entertain it. Like, perhaps that is the Holy Spirit speaking in me. That is truth speaking. There's something about that that doesn't feel completely wrong to me. And, you know, hanging out with you for years, it's led to greater and greater what I perceive to be openness between us, where we might have fought before. There's something else going on because you and I are doing that thing. We're trying, and that thing, you're right, is not the deep selfless freedom that must be true humility, that you're not even really thinking much about yourself. So it's like, and I've
but noticed there's something to respond with intentionally, and I think it's nice to, because I'll be reminded.
Yes,
you know, someone will praise me soon enough, and I'll be reminded soon enough, and I like that as a technique, right? To have answers to moments, like what thought technology can I use in that moment to look and and to turn to, well, there is a divine stream at play here, which I am but a wave upon, and to praise the wave when the power at work here is the ocean, or I don't, maybe it's fucking vice versa, and I don't know. Is not the point. And I don't know how to even exactly articulate the way I experience, yes, the will of God is at play here, as a man who wouldn't use that word for myself, right? Alone in a room with myself, I wouldn't use that word, but I have some real affinity. We talked about for the momentum of this thing that may play the role of grace, when we like it and possibly even when we don't like it.
Yeah. And there's something in humility that feels like if one is able to tap into this living well, we're not so much seeking pleasurable experience as we're seeking what is the mandate of the moment? We're seeking with all our heart in this deep faith in love, like this, what is the thing to do now? And as opposed to that question.
But I also think that that's a false dichotomy. I think that we're, when we look at what we want to do, it can be short-sighted, and we aren't necessarily thinking about the result that we want, and we think about a short-term result and not a long-term result. I accept all that. But even accepting the cross of the moment, even accepting the challenge that just happens to be, I was tripping on acid in whatever, 1932 or something, and I was alone in my, I don't know if I was 18 or 20 or something like that. And my friends left, and we took this, incredible, and I remember, and I had this, moment, and don't do drugs, kids, I'm sorry, but I did. And I remember, having this epiphany and wanting to write it down, and I didn't know, and I couldn't find a piece of paper. And so I found a pen and any scrap of something that I could write down on. And I wrote the words, they ain't nothing to do but what's on our plate. The scrap that I had found, I only kind of realized years later, it was like, oh, it was a fucking paper plate. right. Crafted to some extent, the flavor of my epiphany. But
to continue the metaphor. The right, flavor yes, on the plate.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. I probably had been, pizza on it at some point. We respond in the moment to what the moment calls upon us for, but to what end, right? I mean, what are we, there's still some guidance within us. We can't help but steer one way or another in our action. And, and when we're called to love, is that a different thing than being called to what is pleasurable? Is there a more pleasurable thing than being filled with that spirit? Is there a more pleasurable thing than having a heart filled to the brim with love?
Oh yeah. And when I was talking about pleasures, it was more appetites and things that get, yeah, right. We would have to say that one of the results of that obedience, which is not popular idea, the freedom of that obedience is, I think one of the results is it's peaceful. There's a deep peace. And I don't know if we desire that peace. I think there's something rather terrifying about peace, and that sometimes we busy ourselves with so many projects, lest we slow down enough and have, there's a certain humility required to enter into the kind of dark faith. There's a darkness to faith. It's darkness to certain aspects of the mind or certain aspects of our plans. It's brightness to another part of the being, but it's hard because we have to almost get a taste for water, you know? Yeah, but I like liquor and I like coffee and I like, yeah, but water, my man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I really do like kombucha. Yeah, but just for 40 day, go ahead, just do water. Just water. Right. Try it.
Right.
And you're like, yeah, but I really, no, because I'm here to enjoy. And then my gosh, you try drinking water or maybe just fasting, to use a sort of a crass physical metaphor, or rather a gross, not in the sense of.
And that's a beautiful metaphor because it's a beautiful, like we're rabid. And it came to my mind right away too, right? Hydrophobia, right? Like you're avoiding this thing that will nurture you. And it's not that it's not right. It's sort of a classical Buddhist presentation, frankly. It's not that you can't have what you want. It's not that you can't strive for happiness. It's that the thing that you think is going to make you happy won't do that.
Ain't going to fill the void.
It's not water. It's not water, and your body needs water, right?
Yeah, beautiful.
And you think, but I want, I want this thing and I want that thing, right? And and you're dying of thirst, and you're dying of thirst. And if you could just finally pour enough water down your gullet, right, you would feel amazing. And you would get the feeling that you even are looking for in the, in your monster energy, Red Bull, Ginkgo, Kanobo, Guarana, caffeine, ginseng, right?
Wish I could help. I get another coming. But yeah.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, and then the strange thing about this is that the well, in a sense, there's nothing easier to drink the water there, and yet the habits runs. It's a strange thing. My yoke is easy. My yoke is most difficult. Most difficult for the being who does not know what's good for them and cannot yoga anushasanam, cannot review and follow and take guidance from another. I think humility is expressed very beautifully in the way we respond to advice. And I don't think the well, which is always available, that eternal wellspring of Holy Spirit and like this self-emptying that gives room for grace to do her thing. it happens the guidance doesn't have to even be necessarily right. Oh, it's a whole relationship to the guidance. It's a relationship to, like, when Ben is talking, do I want to be transformed by Ben on this podcast? When we talk right now, do I really want to hear what he has to say and be transformed by him? Really? That's humility. It seems to express itself like that, like, my gosh, I can literally learn from every musician I listen to.
Yeah, right.
I'm a musician. Why would I not learn everyone from the, and that is deeply peaceful. There's a deep inner freedom in that, I think. Yeah. I think,
and that's
great
Guru Yoga, you know, to me, in a way that, you know, I see so many people struggling with, you know, but to take a being and say, whatever this being does, it is a perfect teaching, because everything in the universe is a perfect teaching, because everything in the universe is potentially not if we don't take it that way, but there's this perfect unfolding of what needs to be done in every moment. And if we stand before someone, then they are that perfect unfolding, but I can't handle it. You see, I don't have the guts, you know, or the spiritual girth to handle that for everyone and everything around me. So then I pick this one person. But it's got to be a stepping stone to bigger things, or it becomes stagnation, I think.
Yeah, and Christianity circumvents the guru thing by saying there's only one guru, Lord Jesus Christ, word incarnate, made flesh. And you are to see, you know, people ask, well, when did you ever come to meet Jesus? You die and you see Jesus, you meet truth. You meet the light. You meet heaven, and heaven says, oh, "You didn't feed me when I was hungry. What do you mean? I never saw you. I came to your door in the form of, you never gave hospitality. You refused. What do you mean? Every being who ever came to you was me, dum dum. Like, so in a sense, Christianity, and I have to say, for me, the narrowing of my service to one being and my wife and a few beings was helpful until it was very detrimental.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was a stepping stone, and I believe I stepped on that stepping stone too long and caused undue suffering and misunderstood the ubiquitous import of the Lama. We almost right away, I believe, in serving a Lama, you should start doing that with everybody, right? In my opinion, not because there's a muscle you need to freaking develop. I don't buy it. Yes, I serve my Lama clearly, and now I'm doing this clearly. And as soon as I leave that room, I'm rude to the person in the elevator. It's absolute nonsense. If the service of the Lama is going well, we will naturally see other people as the Lama. It will start to naturally occur. And if our service is not going well, it gets weird. It totally goes off to tracks.
Same, right? I mean, wouldn't you say that a very similar process is at work when Christianity does not go well, right? When it's
the majority of the time, it seems. Yeah, but anyway, maybe. God help us. Maybe.
Right.
Yeah, the misunderstanding of Christianity has perhaps caused more pain in the world than anything in the history of the world. Misunderstanding the cross and turning Christ into an idol and killing other people in that being's name is nonsense. I certainly didn't mean to say somehow Christianity circumvented the problem and we're just hunky-dory. Yeah, it did come off that way. Excuse me. Thank you for pulling me back from the brink.
Well, I assert that drawing on conversations from you. It's not
from our
Right, exactly. That was never my tradition, so it's not my place in the same way to be critical of it from within. I hope I can remember today when someone says something nice to me, to hear it as a praise of what is so much larger than me, of what is moving through me, and then cool. I don't know. Wouldn't it be cool to just sit and And someone says, you know, Kevin, you did such a beautiful job. Thank you so much. That was so amazing what you did. And to be able to look, right, and with all humility say, yeah, right. But you're not looking at you in that way. You're like, yeah, God is good, right?
That sounds, yeah, and maybe you don't say, you know, and I think oftentimes
you, you may not say that, but in your heart,
without
right?
any without any pious ejaculation, you just, you know, just, but yeah, sometimes that too, but it just kind of
you might just say the word thanks, which is cool, but like with right? full joy, knowing that it's right? not, it's just so much bigger than you. The thought that I could manifest all of the circumstances that have come together for you to think I'm so clever right happen. Now is totally. Come on.
Oh, you that know? Is beautiful. The thought that somehow I could manifest all the circumstances that made you look at this room and go, oh, the design and the woodwork, it's so beautiful. And you're like, you like kind of blow on your knuckles and then, you know, rub them on your chest, you know, like, yeah. Yeah. And then you're like, but wait the fuck, wait a minute.
But if you could have all that joy, right? All that Labrador joy, but just like you're... Oh, you're just watching, like you're watching, you know, a firework display together. You know, yeah, that was a good one.
And then when the criticism comes, when the criticism comes, how do we receive criticism? How do we do that? How do we do it? And what is one of the signs?
You know what? It was God's fault. Get off my back.
See what I mean? God was moving through me and I messed up. I don't know what to say. I love it. This is the St. Paul's. That's not what we mean. Okay. No, stop it now. Which is a little difficult where we see a different kind of conception going on where the Christian God if evil happens, it's on us, and then that evil is worked towards good in the Christian conception, and God is only good. Oh, God is beyond concept, but within the extent that we can talk about God, God is infinite goodness, infinite kindness, infinite compassion, infinite, and beyond all, anything that we could think, and like that.
And but that's why I had this weird hunch that assigning grace to the moments where we do some goodness, or assigning grace to the circumstances under which some sweet thing happens, and not assigning it to its converse, it feels highly suspect to me.
I feel that, yeah, right? This comes up for people who have a feeling for Hinduism. You know, Kali, a kind of a conception of God that involves all kinds of mishap and apparent evil or evil, I don't know how we would say it, and good, all of the above, please.
Wrath. We would say wrath.
Wrath. Perhaps. Wrath, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, holy wrath. This Christian God is just come on. It's a narrow conception. And I think it's a very fair
creed. Please. I mean, it also comes out of the God of the Jews, which I, you know, was known for a wrathful interlude or two. You know, seems to have that capacity.
And Christ is a response to that. And I would say that I feel the teachings of the Gospels is everything will be turned to the good. Have faith in that. Have deep hope in that. It will liberate your will to do good. And if you're a social worker, if you're a psychologist, if you're a person working on equal rights or the First and Second Amendment, if you're thinking about what freedom and free speech, a person who's doing this, we work and do it because it's right and not because, oh, we see some immediate effect or some there, this sense that we're, it seems very effective to have that kind of faith and hope can be very liberative, and I think there is a humility in having that kind of hope in goodness.
Christ does manifest wrath at times, though. Yes, I mean the money changers and such.
Oh yes, and statements. You know, or like it'd be better for you that a millstone was tied around your neck.
Right.
And or it'd be better for you to cut off your left hand and go into the afterlife maimed. than to do what you're doing right now, to engage in. So this is very stern talk.
Yeah. So how is my, yeah, right. We're getting to criticism. I mean, it's one thing to say, how is my, how are my challenges? We're getting to it, or I'm avoiding it. I don't know. It's hard for me. It's hard for me to accept criticism. It is, it is still hard. And I've known that it was hard for me a long time, and it hasn't made it easy yet. And I wonder if this humility that I feel so comfortable asserting when things are going well can act as a stepping stone to help me to gain some clarity on how. I mean, I think, and I think it's, it is there. It's built on this kind of casting aside an idea of, it isn't really a criticism of me per se, right? Like, if I accept that I am the source of one, then I am the source of the other. Like, it is a criticism of all, but it's also just like, this is what, it's just what needs to be worked on. This is just what is before you. This is what's before you to be worked on. There's some tension to be soothed. There's some work to be done. There's some place where the flowing of love into the void of a certain body is not apparent. And then what do we do for the health of that body when there is not life, when there's not breath in that place? And there's, it doesn't have to be an accusation of me either. If I cast aside this idea of me, and that's always what it seems to have to be, right? Again and again, religion after religion, system after system, that this protection of me, work so hard to protect me, and that's hard to get around. It's so hard to get around. I feel uncomfortable just talking about how to get better at accepting criticism. I feel the criticism of knowing that I'm not good at accepting criticism, and not wanting to fix it. And like, I don't want to fix it. I just like to get criticized less, please. And that'll do.
And it is interesting to note that the more open we can become to criticism, which I deeply struggle with, I tend to receive it poorly and then go away into my hollow and lick my wounds and then be like, oh shit, that's something I need to work on. That being is criticizing the thing in me that needs to die. Thank you so much. You are my liberator. I can do mental gymnastics apart from the heat of the moment. And after licking my wounds or denying it, or saying, well, I'm on a spectrum, but I'm not that bad. Or that guy has it and he's projecting it onto me. And indeed, there's a little bit of me, but I kind of worked that out a decade ago. Or whatever the mind does upon receiving the information from another being. But there's this thing in Christianity where the apostles, and they get into a kick of like, bring it on. Like literally in the morning practice, I'm gonna put myself in situations where I'm gonna receive some heat, and Lord Christ, be my strength in that moment today. I know I'm gonna have to make this phone call. Be my and let me take it on. And then the interesting result of that, and I only know but a little bit from having done this, a very little bit, pulled it off a few times, is the openness to the criticism opens the other being, and the criticism shifts, and the whole relationship shifts, is a shift in the relationship. All of a sudden, this person feels safer with me, or he just received that and didn't go into, you know, well, screw you, man, and took it in. And then strangely, there seems to be less and less criticism in one's life, I would imagine. that mm-hmm. opening fully to it. And so
I'm suspicious of myself when I at how appealing that is as a goal to work towards in my acceptance of criticism. You know, that it should stop. Just,
you're so great. This is so great. So great. You always go right to the, aren't we all feeling it? I mean, that's, yeah. It's a damned catch 22 if there ever was one. I mean,
I don't trust myself there. And there's probably something in that moment, right, where it's okay to let that play out and have a good damn sense of humor.
You know, that person is going to disrespect me and they're not going to knock on the door and I'm going to be in the middle of something and bring it on. In fact, do a Zoom meeting right outside my office window so I can hear you talking without asking. In fact, let the kids, it's some kind of, like, please show me these edges. I am in trouble and then again, that's can be crazy too, because it can be unrealistic. And then I'm trying to lift weight that I simply cannot lift and it backfires, which I've done many times. Like today I'm going to really receive criticism in a good way, you know, and kind of almost like lean into it. And then it backfires and I'm worse off than I was. So then, you know, it's sort of like, you want to just slowly, you don't want to go cold turkey when you start eating again or go cold turkey fasting. You want to just kind of ease your way into to the heavy lifting of, you know, bring on the cross.
Like, I'm going to try. And I'm going to try this week and see how it goes. And maybe doing it when I'm praised will help me to do it when I'm criticized. But I think that there's also a sort of pride in accepting a cross that is not ours to take on. Ooh. And I think that here I am again, resistant to casting off the praise that I don't deserve, resistant and saying, well, it's okay. You know, when I'm praised, I'm in a better mood anyway. So I feel a little braver to say, you know, look, you're casting praise upon God's work. No problem. Right. But then I'm weary or I'm suspicious of myself when I say, well, when they criticize God's work, but it's not wrong exactly. Like I say, it's cute, whatever, to blame God in that moment. But, but it's not wrong exactly. And it doesn't mean whatever, they're dummies because they're criticizing God. It just means that they're criticizing something bigger, and that's okay. And I don't have to bear that cross per se. And I think it's worth me looking at. And I'm weird. Yeah. Don't think I don't step with trepidation, because I do. But I do have this suspicion, right? That like it's okay a little bit. Like this is where it's okay to say it's okay. Like it's not really you they're criticizing. And this is your cross to sit here and be a part of it and accept it and work with it, you know? But it's not that. It's that same you that didn't deserve the praise because he doesn't exist, that doesn't deserve the criticism because he doesn't exist. And it's the same you that sits here in the presence of praise and must work with the praise and be in the presence of praise. And that is your job here. It's the same you that must be in the role of what is being criticized, but it's not really me, and it's okay. And I'm afraid to tell myself that, you see, I'm afraid, it's,
I almost want to go like, I think
true though. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cashin, who collected all the sayings of a lot of the sayings of the Desert Fathers, 1800 years ago or so, collected something, or 1500 years ago, 600 years ago, collected something called these institutes and all these advices. And when the praise comes, you talked about kind of, see it as from God. Well, absorb it and pass it on. And when the criticizes comes, absorb it and give it to God. Cashin would be like, absorb it. And then, so it's almost like, it's not like, oh no, it's not me. Well, it's you and it's not you. It's both. Absorb it and pass it on. So there's room for the next beauty to come. Like the stream, you're a pool, that where the body is there of water, but then it's going into this next stream. The pool absorbs the water. It doesn't say I'm not that stream, and then it passes it on. And I think of John Donne, the poet, you know, and he's, the love that can be kept is only the love that is given away. Similarly, in a way, when we see the praises from God, it actually builds up the sacred body of Christ in the world, the sacred connected body of all beings. The sacred interconnectedness is built when we absorb the praise, like, thank you. And then moving it on, almost as if it knits the tapestry more clearly. It and the same with the criticism. Yep, mm-hmm. I know I do that. I absorb it and I go working on it. I'm going to try. I'll try harder and then pass it. Don't, you know, and then this perseveration that I've done for years and this self beating myself up, it's mm-hmm. totally a form of pride. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely a form of pride. Shame is pride's mm-hmm. cloak. And I feel all shameful and then I'm all torn up and then I'm like, oh, I'm not. And it just, it's a terrible spiral and it happens every day. And that,
I feel closer. I feel closer today, you know, to to understanding this connection that's been eluding me a little bit about the connection between pride and shame, and that I don't have to own it in the way that I have. And
thank you. And I'm more comfortable with that. Yes, exactly. It's not me, but you know, I want to say per se, right? But then also, you just want to say what you said. It's not me.
Okay, I'm gonna go now into the world and try it out, and we'll see how long it is before someone kindly criticizes me to try on my shoes. You know, I don't know my acceptance shoes or my non-acceptance. I don't know if I'm accepting or not accepting this criticism. We'll see how it goes. Mm. I love you, dude. I'm gonna go try it out. I'm very grateful for our time together.
Thanks for taking the time, bro.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.